You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis.
In the casinos, they have the deal or no deal slot machines. And I was in another casino, not this casino, a couple of weeks back. This is a true story. Talk about awkward. My wife is with me, and we have another couple, Louie and Kathy. And Louie and Kathy go down to the casino. My wife calls me in a couple of minutes in my room and says, Kathy just hit the jackpot on the deal or no deal machine. She just won $10,000. Oh, and this will change her life. She's crying. I could hear the screaming. She says, Howie, you got to come down and see this. I put on my coat. I run out of the room. I run down the hall, down the elevator, across the casino. I see the lights going off on the machine. I go there. Kathy is crying. They're peeling off $100 bills. They're giving her $10,000. I give her like a big hug and everything. And I see all these lights around me. And I look and people are taking pictures and they're holding up their cell phones because I just realized they don't know that this is my friend. They think that if you hit the jackpot on the deal or no deal machine, I show up.
Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. That was a clip from Howie Mandel's new hour-long comedy special, Howie Mandel Presents Howie Mandel at the Howie Mandel Comedy Club, which airs this Friday at 10 Eastern on Showtime. It's his first stand-up special in over 20 years, and you might think that he's just been too busy between hosting Deal or No Deal and judging America's Got Talent. But today, Howie says that comedy is still his first love, and even now, he still manages to do up to 200 comedy shows a year. He talks about his childhood growing up in Toronto and how the show Candid Camera inspired him to pull an elaborate prank that got him expelled from high school. He shares how winging it, his first time on stage, turned into his signature improvisational style, why he still thrives on audience interaction, and how he's grown to love doing corporate gigs simply for the challenge of it. He recalls his very first time on The Johnny Carson Show, how the HBO Young Comedian special changed his life, and the time when the comic with no discernible acting experience auditioned for a sitcom and ended up the star of the serious TV medical drama St. Elsewhere. He reveals why he originally turned down the offer to host Deal or No Deal, and the anxiety he gets whenever he sees contestants making bad decisions on the show. He opens up about his struggles with obsessive-compulsive disorder and how he went from fearing that it might be a career killer to using his fame to raise awareness of mental health issues. Plus, Howie Mandel gives the secret to winning the golden buzzer on America's Got Talent. Coming up in just a moment. Folks, you know comedian, actor, and all-around showman Howie Mandel as the host of the game show Deal or No Deal and is one of the judges of the hit variety show America's Got Talent. Now he's returning to his comedy roots for his first solo stand-up special in 20 years. It's called Howie Mandel Presents Howie Mandel at the Howie Mandel Comedy Club, which premieres Friday, January 18th at 10 p.m. Eastern on Showtime. Howie Mandel, thanks for sitting down with me.
My pleasure. I was sitting down. I don't know if it's with you. You're sitting down. I feel like I'm sitting down by myself, but it's good that I didn't realize there's a buddy system. No, because we're in a building. No, but all I'm saying is because we're in a building and there's other people sitting. So I didn't realize.
Maybe we're all sitting down together then.
Thank you for sitting down.
Some weird metaphysical way or something.
I have no idea, but I'm thrilled to be here. and I'm thrilled to be part of this.
Well, thank you. Now, 20 years since your last stand-up special. Why the long hiatus? Just too much
on your plate? I didn't
want
to do one. No. You know, the truth is that I have never stopped doing stand-up, and I've been doing like over 100 live stand-up dates a year, regardless of what I do. And it's my primal scream at the end of the day. And whether you see me on AGT or Deal or No Deal, and the fact that I haven't been doing stand-up anywhere on television, I think there's a whole, almost a whole generation that doesn't even know me as a comic. And that is something that I never stop doing, always enjoy doing. It is my breath of fresh air at the end of the day. It's the only thing that I do that gets an immediate response. There's no editing, no marks to hit, no commercials to throw to, no broadcasting. It also keeps me real because it's the only thing that I do that keeps me out of LA and New York, and I get to stand in front of real people. And as somebody who is a broadcaster or on television, I kind of have a sense of what real people, how they think, what they relate to, what they react to. So I'll never stop doing that. That being said, the people that know me from Deal or No Deal or know me from America's Got Talent, which are great family viewing, I don't think what I do on Showtime on my special is great for the whole family.
Yeah, in the opening to the special, you actually say that you have some anxiety over the fact that you might say something in the moment that might impact all the other stuff that you're doing. Like you said, these family shows, Deal or No Deal and AGT.
That compounded with the effect of where we are today in our political correctness. You know, people, you're treading, you know, it's like without a net. Yeah. And you know, the stand-up comedy was, that's what I loved about it. That's why I fell into it. That's why I continue to do it, was my one island of freedom, you know? And it's not as free as it was. And part of that is the fact that everybody has access, you know, without context. So you could say something in a club or say something on a show, then somebody writes about it. And
or videotapes it on their phone.
Right.
I mean, it's weird that, you know, it used to be that people went to a comedy club just to have a good time and laugh, have a few drinks, have fun. Now it's like everyone goes to a comedy club and everyone has a phone in their hand and they're just waiting to play gotcha.
Yeah, or else they're just trying to record their memory. I say to people, I see people sometimes sitting. You know, I know Dave Chappelle and a couple of the other comics, they tell people to put their phones. They have these packets.
Right.
Where they're locked away. I haven't done that. And so sometimes I'll show up someplace or I'm at a concert and somebody's sitting there with their phone recording and they're looking at their phone and they're looking at the screen. I think they're missing the moment. And I say, this is great that you're recording, because when you go home and you watch this, it'll seem like you were actually there. Because, you know, comedy needs to be kind of enjoyed in the moment.
Yeah.
And it's not even something that even when you enjoy it, that you can, you know, reiterate to somebody. And it really is, you have to be there, regardless of who it is. I mean, there is something electric and fun and edgy about being in the moment. And, you know, if there are moments that cross the line, if there is, wherever that line is, it's kind of fun to be there and witness to it instead of, you know, catching somebody and spreading it out there and let everybody comment on this out of context moment.
Yeah. And it's weird, especially for you, a guy who does so much crowd work and kind of seems to thrive off the interaction with the crowd, to have a crowd that's that unengaged.
Well, I think that we're, I don't know if it's unengaged as much as, you know, this.
Or technically, I think the word is disengaged. Actually, I think I did that.
Well, disengaged. Yeah. I think they're engaged in multitasking. I think they're engaged. They're listening to you. They're watching you. Mm-hmm. They're recording you. They're texting somebody. They're receiving something. They're getting an update. There's a call. They're working. They're thinking about something else. I think that we all, by virtue of being around in this millennium, are kind of, I would imagine while somebody listens to this podcast, there's something else going on at the same time. Whereas when I was growing up, it was whatever you were doing at the moment is what you were doing at the moment. There wasn't even, I mean, I remember the excitement of just getting a phone in my car. You know, the fact that you can make a phone call from the car, but now you can make a phone call, you can listen to a podcast, you can, you know, read a book, hear a book on tape all at the same time. You know, there are so many different things you can do at once. And unless you're firing on all those, you know, spark plugs, you're not holding anybody's attention. So I think the audience doesn't really sit and listen and enjoy anymore.
Well, I know that you have ADD and I have ADD. We both have ADD. And it seems like everything that we have coming at us today is a nightmare for someone. Or is it a blessing for someone who has ADHD or ADD?
I think it's a blessing. You know, the truth is that really? I can't
to have
focus
enough
for
to
a
fill
lot.
All that.
Yeah. You know, distraction is the best remedy. You know, I mean, distraction is the problem, but it is also the best. You know, for somebody who has trouble focusing on one thing with much power for any length of time, It is great that our society and entertainment is set up now so that you don't have to. You know, like it doesn't exist anymore. But Vine was perfect. You know, 6 seconds.
Yeah.
And if you want to binge watch, you know, three in a row, that's 18 seconds of your time. And you got to censor pop culture or a little YouTube videos or whatever you're watching on Instagram or Facebook as you scroll by. You can kind of take in a lot in a short amount of time. So for people that are impaired or were impaired by this diagnosis, it's actually fitting for, you know, you grew into the culture or the culture grew into us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you kind of just have to fill all of those hours or, you know, all of the monotony and so forth, which you seem to do really well because you've got this special, you've got AGT, you've got Deal or No Deal. You've got, somewhere I read you do up to 200 dates a year, live shows.
Yeah.
You don't seem to slow down too much.
It's not really a lot. I mean, in the real world, And wherever I travel, most people work at least, if you're lucky enough to have a job, you work 40 hours a week at one place, Monday to Friday. You know, if I show up and do an episode of something or, you know, I'll sit here with you for an hour and that's, you know, my day. And then maybe I can get in a plane and go do a show for 90 minutes. And that's maybe part of a day or I can go tape an episode of America's Got Talent, and it is what it is, what you see. I'm sitting there watching a show. It doesn't take a lot of, you know, mental prowess or any set of any. I don't have to prepare or do anything. And Deal or No Deal, the game unfolds as it unfolds, you know, and stand up. It kind of unfolds. I don't feel like I put in a full day's work. I feel like one of the luckiest people I know.
Do you do a lot of corporate gigs? I'm assuming some of those 200 are corporate gigs.
Yeah, a lot of corporate.
Especially someone who's well-known like you.
And I love that. Yeah. You know, they pay big money, but it's kind of not traditionally your audience or a comedy audience.
Yeah.
So, which I've learned, I used to fear it and kind of hate it and take the check. And now I absolutely love it. It is so, it becomes the challenge for me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You like
and they
that.
Make it, after all these years, you know, I've been doing it for 40 years. I look for the challenge. I don't want it to be easy. I kind of understand why people could get bored on stage doing the same act each and every night. But when you have something, you know, or if somebody walks into a Howie Mandel concert or you turn on Showtime to watch my special, you're kind of there knowing that, you know, who I am and what you're getting. When you show up at a sales dinner for, you know, some pharmaceutical company and they say, we have a surprise speaker, like they always, a big part of it is they go, we didn't tell anybody you're here. And I go, well, why is that a good, you know, I'd like them to at least know that they're going to laugh or they might want to laugh or we didn't tell them there's any comedy tonight and we didn't tell them it was you. And they also add to your repertoire which you would never do to a singer, but they say, you know, it'd be funny. Dave is our CFO and everybody makes fun of his golf game. So if you can mention Dave's golf score and especially his weakness in putting, I'm telling you, this place will go wild. And I used to kind of adhere to what they're really? The buyer. And I used to go, you know, that joke went over like Dave putts. And speaking of putts, I feel like a putt because it was just silent and they didn't know. But you would never, if you hired a singer for the same gig, you would never tell, you know, could you change the lyrics in the second round?
I mean,
in the second chorus.
Yeah, middle management in an insurance company is probably like the worst comedy writer. That's kind of crazy. Now, I understand that you started out when you were a kid, you were inspired by Alan Funt and one of my favorites, Candid Camera. And I guess at some point there's some story where you kind of decided to do your own candid camera, well, minus the camera.
Well,
and it didn't go so well, huh?
My whole life.
Yeah.
My whole life. Really? In my earliest memories, besides dealing with whatever mental health issues I had, is my parents, who were very supportive and everything, laughter was huge in my house. And
really?
Whether they were watching The Tonight Show or whether they were watching, you know, some variety show or listening to a comedy album, they were always laughing. And I remember being a toddler, you know, 3 or 4 years old and wanting to be part of it. You know, you're drawn toward laughter. Mm-hmm. You know that's a fun time and you want to be part of it. And I remember going into the living room and if they were watching a comic on television, you know, and he'd be talking about his mother-in-law and everybody would be laughing. I had no point of reference. I didn't know what a mother-in-law was.
Yeah.
Like we would not. So yeah, my parents would be laughing and I'd be looking at like, I want to laugh too. I think I want to know why this is funny. And my first recollection of being aware of what was funny and joining the party was Alan Funt. On a Sunday night, he had a show called Candid Camera. And he actually, rather than him being a comic, explained to me and the audience at home what he was going to do. And I remember specifically, you know, the bit was that they had this fake office. They were going to hire a receptionist. He was going to pretend to be the boss. And he was telling the person, the ladies that were asked to be the receptionist, you cannot miss a phone call. I'm going out for an hour. You must take every phone call because I live and die by these phone calls. Here's what he's going to do. He tells me that he's going to tie a rope to you could see on the leg of the desk. The desk is kind of on a roller thing. The rope goes through the wall to the next room. So every time the phone rings and the receptionist goes to reach for the phone, we're going to pull the rope and the desk is going to move away right across the room. And I remember feeling it was exciting because it was that anticipation of a surprise party. They're coming up the driveway. They're coming up. I can't wait to see it. And I remember looking at my mom and looking at my dad. We were all like just on the edge of laughter. Oh, I can't wait to see this. And then the first girl sits down and the phone rings and then they pull the rope and her jaw drops. And I and my mother and my father were hysterical, like crying. It was funny. And it's funny on so many levels, not only because we felt like we were in on the joke, but it's relatable. What would I do if that happened? Would I be scared?
Yeah.
Would I believe it? Would I think it was a joke? It's very relatable. And that was such a good feeling, just that laughter.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember
everyone loves to pull pranks on everyone.
Well, it's just the most relatable thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be on your friends. It's just like,
right. But everyone likes to do it.
It's always been a staple of television and YouTube and whatever, and whether it's prank calls, just because it's the most relatable thing. You know,
and not
it's
everyone
human
is
reaction.
And not everyone is a stand-up comic. Many people might be in their living room and would never get up on stage and start telling jokes, but we all like to screw with our family or friends and stuff like that.
Here's where, so that good feeling, I went, oh, no, I got to recapture that.
Oh, yeah.
And I did not, nor was I smart enough or even old enough, but it went on for years to realize, well, number one, I don't have a TV show. Number two, I don't have an audience. And number three, I don't really have friends, but I want to do this. This is what I want to do. So I remember like one night bored at home, I went through the Yellow Pages and I called a construction company, gave my name, Howard Mandel, and asked the guy to come to the school to give a quote on an addition to the library. And because I thought it would be funny, I'm just a student. I don't have the authority to do that. There's no addition putting on. And when I'm sitting in math, to see this guy out in the field or measure or whatever. But as I was alluding to earlier, I didn't know that it would be better if I had an audience.
Yeah.
I didn't
you
have
just
any,
did it
just
for
me. It's just something I did in the moment, which made me laugh. And it felt like very candid camera-ish. And a prank, but I didn't have an audience or I didn't set it up for anybody. It was just me alone. So these stories about me having a construction worker outside, which I got in trouble with, me coming up with a chocolate bar in my mouth that looked like a piece of shit, me, doing crazy things in class became more behavioral problems. And I was asked to leave school and I don't have a GED. And as I say to everybody, anything I've ever been punished for, expelled for, hit for is what I seem to get paid for today.
Wow. Now, your first stand-up gig, I guess, was, or if you can call it a gig, was it what, Yuck Yucks over in
Toronto?
So it was
a dare. So
oh, really?
I went to, you know, I wasn't big on dancing. You're talking about the early 70s disco was all the rage. And I wasn't into disco, nor did I have anybody to go disco dancing with. Mm-hmm. And there was this kind of sweeping wave of stand-up comedy clubs taking the world.
That was the big boom.
You know, from the Comedy Store, the Improv, and Catch a Rising Star in New York. And they opened this club called Yuk Yuks, and I had read about it. And we went there one night in lieu of going to a disco. And I saw these stand-up comics. It was really funny. It's the first time I saw live stand-up, you know, monologists talking about what at that time in the 70s was very edgy and different. And I went, oh my God, this is so exciting. And the owner of the club is Mark Breslin. And he comes out after and he goes, listen, if you feel that you have the wares to do this, you know, we're going to Monday nights at midnight, you're welcome to come on, amateurs. And the person at my table said, you should do it. And I went, okay, with no thought. And again, no preparation, no thinking about what the ramifications could be. I just thought it would be funny to just fuck around. And, you know, I'm not a comic. I have no aspiration to be a comedian or be in show business.
No prepared set or anything. Huh?
No. And I just thought it would be funny. The joke would be, in my mind, without thinking it through, they'll go, ladies and gentlemen, man, can you believe it? I'm going to get up on stage. What do I have to offer? I have absolutely nothing to offer. That's the joke. That's the end of it.
Yeah.
You know, just like I never had an ending. I'm going to come up with the shit in my mouth. And then what am I going to do? Nothing. I'm going to hire somebody to put an addition onto the library. And then what am I going to do? And nothing. And nobody's going to know about it. So this was just my own little joke with my friend. And I'll never forget that night. You know, 12:10, it was April 1977, I hear, ladies and gentlemen, Howie Mandel. And I walk out on that stage, and I had never been on a stage before, and the light is bright and shining and burning your retinas, and you kind of look down from the light, and the front row, you see one or two or three tables, and there's people that I don't know waiting in anticipation. And then you feel like really vulnerable. They're waiting. Bad. Like, what are you going to do? Like, we don't get it. It's not a joke. It's the first time I was face to face with one of my impromptu brilliant ideas.
Yeah.
You know, and I was actually seeing faces like, okay, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
And like I got this gush of adrenaline and fear. And if you watch any of my old YouTube stints as a stand-up comic, or even my first specials or my Young Comedian special, that was real and legitimate. I didn't have anything. So I went in my mind in the moment, I was thinking, I got to come up with something. And if you remember my act, or you saw my act, it's 40 years ago. I went, okay.
Yeah.
And that just came out of nervousness, you know? Okay. And as I was going, okay, all right. And they could see I was trying to think of something. They started to giggle at my nervous energy. And I heard them giggle. And then I would go, what? What are you giggling
That's
at?
Right.
And then my whole thing became this, you know, really contorting, nervous young guy who was just looking for the, and I didn't know what to do. And I still had OCD. I had my hands in my pocket. And I carried rubber gloves because I didn't want to touch germs.
Yeah.
And okay, I'll do this. And I pulled it over my head for no reason at all. I've never done that before. And as I started breathing through my nose, the fingers were going up and down. Yeah. And the crowd was roaring. And I'm going, oh, my God, this is a... And then I walked off stage. I went, thank you, good night. And I walk off stage. And Mark Breslin said, that was very good. You're really unique. Would you like to come back tomorrow? And I went, okay.
Wow. And that never happens, you know.
No. And then I went back. And I was... That's I did incredible. It, and that became my act. And, you know, I had these funny voices that I did, you know, like, which eventually became Bobby, but it was just
a baby,
you know, and I would do those things. And those are things that I did in the back of classrooms just because I could do it. I originally got that voice from choking on a piece of cake and the air was really? Blocked, you know, in my throat. Like nothing was, you know, a plan. And then as luck would have it, on a separate business trip to LA, I went out and I got, And I had met Mike Binder, who is a writer, comedian, director. He had funny because guy. He was from Detroit, he came and played at Yuk Yuks. I started hanging out at Yuk Yuks. And I was happy and going on stage, but not because I wanted or even believed that I could ever make a living at this or do this. It was like-minded, weird people who had these odd little thoughts and shared them with strangers. And for me, my analogy is like, if you like playing poker and twice a week you get together with a group of people and that's my poker game on Thursday nights and, yeah. and Tuesday nights, or you like playing basketball and you have one-on-one at the Y with your friends. This was my couple of nights a week. I'd go over to Yuck Yucks and do that. So I met comics who were coming in from over the border, like Mike Binder, who was out of Detroit, and Dave Coulier. And I went to California on a business trip, something not related in retail. And I told Mike I'm coming out, because he knew that he was, I knew that he was living there. And he said, I'll get you on at the Comedy Store. And he got me on at the Comedy Store. And it was just about getting on at the Comedy Store, just because it'd be fun to say I did that on vacation. It turns out there was a producer in the audience from a comedy game show called Make Me Laugh. And he said, do you want to do TV? And I said, oh, yeah, you know, thinking this is, what are the chances? You're in Hollywood. This sounds like such a Hollywood line. I don't know. The, he said, come to my office the next day. And I ended up going to his studio. It was KTLA. And I was, and he said, make my secretary laugh. And I it was like, okay. He's again. And she started laughing. He goes, you're great. And they shot the next day, you know, five shows in one day, strip. Show. And they stripped it for 5 days. I was there for a couple of hours. I went home, continued in my business, lived in Toronto. And as it aired, I started getting recognition. You know, this is the 70s. So it, just being on TV changed somebody's lives. It's not like today. Today, you could be on TV. You could be in the hit series.
No one would ever notice with so many channels.
You know, I defy, well, not even with, you know, the number one show on TV is NCIS. Aside from Mark Harmon and LL Cool J, who's on the other one, I would like you to go down the list and name the entire cast.
I have no idea.
You know, whereas if Happy Days was on that time, you knew Donnie Most, who was the, you know, the third tier. Like, you know, so just being on TV got me recognition. It wasn't on in Canada. And I started getting calls from talk shows. So I'd fly back and do talk shows. And then Gene Simmons saw me from Kiss. And he asked me to open up for his girlfriend and his girlfriend at the time. And he was living with Diana Ross. So I became Diana Ross's opening act in Vegas without an act.
Really? Yes. Now, how did that go? Because I'm always not surprised when I hear of singers who hire comedians to be their opening act. I feel like they had seen me on TV. People come to hear a singer.
They didn't want to see me. The lights would go down at Caesar's Palace. The crowd would roar. And you'd hear the announcer go, Caesar's Palace is proud to present an evening of Diana Ross. And you'd and if you listened really closely, nobody did. Nobody heard. But I could hear, because I was standing beside the guy that was announcing. They said, and now, but first, Howie Mandel. Not even comedian Howie Mandel. And I'd walk out and I'd have this sea of people looking at me like, what the fuck are you doing here?
Yeah.
We're not interested. And it was just silent. And my wife, who's I'm still married to, took a picture of me on those nights, and I'd be wearing a sports jacket. You could see the sweat right through the sports. I would sweat through my shirt, my sports jacket. It was just flop sweat. But she liked me and thought I was funny, so she kept me on. But it was really hard.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Howie Mandel when we come back in just a minute. And it's interesting to hear you talk about the immediacy of how these things just kind of came together for you. And I hear that from comics of your generation, how it was one of those things where you could go in, get on stage at the Comedy Store, and within a week, get booked on Carson. And next thing you know, a few days later, you have a sitcom deal.
Well, the point was,
it doesn't happen like that anymore.
No, because there's so many, you know, there isn't anymore one place to go.
Right. You know, there are a million gatekeepers now, or no gatekeepers.
Right. And it could be your own gate, right? You could be in your own room, in your underpants, sitting on your bed, doing a vlog, and then boom, that explodes. Yeah. And you've got, you know, a worldwide audience, and you're making millions of dollars, and, you know, you're PewDiePie, who's a gamer. Right.
But no one anoints you like Carson did back in the day. What was that first Carson?
I did 22 Johnny Carson. It was pretty amazing. I tried to get on Carson. I couldn't get on the Johnny Carson show. So as it turns out, I met Joan Rivers.
And who Joan, was doing the guest spots or the guest host
and
for him.
Just blowing it up. And Joan saw me and put me on.
Okay.
He saw me on with Joan and said, would you come back next week? And I did it with him and then did it 22 times afterwards.
Wow.
But it was really hard. And that was the litmus test for a comedian, even beyond people who were in the business. Like, if you weren't known and somebody walked up to you anywhere in the streets of Cleveland and said, what do you do? And you say, I'm a comedian. They would go, well, have you ever been on Johnny Carson? And if you said no, and there was many years when it was a no, then they go, okay. So it was like, call me when you do that, because that's going to legitimize you. You know, I had done Mike Douglas and Merv Griffin, but until I did Carson, I was not. My big anointment for, you know, being able to sell tickets and get known was the HBO Young Comedian special.
Yeah.
And on my Young Comedian special, the cast was me, Jerry Seinfeld, Harry Anderson.
Who, Richard Lewis?
Richard Lewis, Maureen Murphy.
Yeah. And that was huge, the HBO Young Comedian specials back then. You didn't have a million different channels.
And my life was never the same.
Yeah.
You know, and that the Young Comedian special then, again, was, you know, you had three stations and then your local, you know, Fox didn't exist. So you had ABC, NBC, and CBS. And then you had a couple of local stations. And then the advent of this new cable, like HBO. And HBO was blossoming at the same time as stand-up comedy. So there was no place where you could hear, you know, a young person that you can relate to being a little blue, you know, or provocative or a little bit edgy. So once you aired on that, I could sell out theaters. And I was playing like 5,000 and 10,000 seat theaters, you know, and I hired
Then St. Elsewhere, did that come after that or before?
Yeah, that was way after that. So that was in 1982. I figured I'd already kind of blossomed as a comic. And the normal path for everybody, you know, when you look at Robin Williams and Billy Crystal and even Richard Pryor at the time, is they got a TV series.
Yeah, right. But a sitcom, not a medical drama.
I know. That's the problem. Yeah. So what happened was I went in to try to get a sitcom, and I went to a general meeting at MTM, Mary Tyler Moore. They were the purveyors of great
sitcoms.
They
were doing everything. Newhart and all these things.
Newhart and everything. And it was just a general meeting with their casting people for maybe developing a Howie Mandel, you know, pilot or something. And as we're talking for a couple of minutes, she goes, well, do you act? And I said, well, I think I can. You know, I don't know. I've never studied. I don't know, but I can be myself and I can, and I'm comfortable. And she goes, read this. And so she gave me a little piece of a script, and I read it, and it was all this medical terminology. I didn't get it, but she goes, that's very good. I go, thank you. She goes, come down the hall. And I went down the hall, and there was a bunch of executives sitting in a room. She goes, listen to this. And I read it again, and they said, thank you. And I went home, and my wife said, how did that go? This is a Friday. I went home. My wife says, how did that go? And I went, well, they said, thank you, but I'm going to be totally honest with you. And I know they got a lot. I love Newhart. I love the Mary Tyler Moore show. The Tony Randall show was on at the time.
Mm-hmm.
They do good comedies. Mostly sitcoms. They do really good comedies. The one I think that they had me in mind for, not funny. It didn't even make sense to me. And maybe I was reading something out of context. Not funny. I get a call within an hour of getting home, and they said, we'd like you to come and meet Brandon Tartikoff.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I went down.
People don't even know that name today, probably, but like he was the boy wonder of NBC.
I'm going to turn it off.
It's okay.
I'm taking calls. The banker calls, no matter where I am.
I'm always
taking offers. Anyway, Brandon Tartikoff was the king of television. Tartikoff made TV what it is. He's probably the last really passionate network executive that would go against, you know, now if you put something out and it doesn't work, it's gone.
Yeah.
If he believes in something, he's the guy that's responsible for putting Seinfeld on the air. Mm-hmm. He's the guy that's responsible for leaving Cheers on the air, which wasn't doing good in its first two seasons.
He created NBC Thursday nights.
He created. Yeah. And also what went on to, you know, these big ensemble shows that were the St. Elsewhere's and the Hill Street Blues, which became ER or even Chicago Hope and all these other shows. You know, he found that formula and stood behind it, even when nobody was watching, and would keep it, you know, renewing them for another year. So I had to meet the king of TV. He was the Wizard of Oz. He's the man behind the curtain. And so I go down to his office. This is an hour after I had gotten home. And those same executives that I had read gone down the hall that Molly had brought me to are sitting in the office of Brandon Tartikoff. I went to Burbank and I read that same unfunny scene. He goes, we'll see you Monday. So I figure I'm going to get another call back Monday. So as it turns out, I started on Monday. they had an order for 13 episodes of St. Elsewhere. They started taping, filming the pilot. They were looking at their dailies, like at the stuff they had shot. They weren't happy with a couple of the characters and wanted to make changes. And it just so happens, it was serendipitous, that the day that I came in for the general meeting, for whatever reason, they saw me as maybe a replacement and wanted to check me out. So I went in on a Friday to meet to get a, and they said, "You're starting." My agent called me and said, "Congratulations, they made you an offer. You're going to be on a..." And I'm on a medical drama? Like, what the fuck is that? What is that? Where did that come from?
Yeah.
And I did it.
Yeah.
You know? And
there must have been, they must have been trying to fill a hole, huh?
They did. I replaced somebody.
Really? Who? Yeah. Do you know?
I do know. And he went on to win an Academy Award. It was David Paymer.
Oh, yeah. Mr. Saturday Night.
Yeah. He played Billy Crystal's brother in Mr. Saturday Night. Yeah. So he looked for another Jewy looking guy that would be Fiscus, but he was the first Fiscus. So I replaced him. I always felt bad about it, but then he did really well on his own.
Yeah.
And I continued to get, fan mail. That time we didn't have email. I would get fan mail that said, I have a bet with my husband that the Dr. Fiscus is not the same guy that puts the rubber glove on his head. You know, so I've always had like a real fractured audience, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
even when I got that. Bobby's World was young mothers who sat at home with their three-year-old kids and kind of knew who I was, but didn't. They weren't the viewers of St. Elsewhere. They weren't the viewers of, you know, my HBO stuff, or they came out to concerts. So I've always had this real fractured audience. Not until 2005, when I did Deal or No Deal, did all those audiences come together.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny. It seems like it's a function of the fact that your act was pretty fractured, at least, you know, then it was, and it still is in some ways. You do a lot of different stuff. You know, one minute you're physical, one minute you're doing voices, you're doing prop comedy, you're doing observational stuff. So there's a certain fractured element to the act.
There is a fractured element to everybody. I think that we are close to that fractured element.
Interesting.
I think that, everybody overthinks. You know, it's given me, even though it's given me a great career, it's given me a philosophy in life. And the couple of things that I've said no to, which are few and far between, I regret. We have a tendency, and we learn to overthink it. You know how that's going to be viewed? You know how that's going to be, and we all do what we think we should do. And it's even down to how we dress during the day. When you get up in the morning, you get dressed, you look in the mirror, and this is how you've decided not only you want to present yourself, how you believe that you will be presented or perceived. Instead of just, you look at a kid, get dressed in the morning, they don't put that much thought into it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think our lives have to be kind of in line with that if you want success. And that's why my biggest philosopher in life, in my career and my life, is Nike. And that is just do it.
Just do it.
Just do it.
That's interesting, because from what I've heard, it sounds like you kind of almost talked yourself out of doing Deal or No Deal originally when you got the offer, like that.
Well, that's exactly right. So with this philosophy, I tell you that, which kind of is a good precursor to the story. So in 2005... obviously, the series was over. My career, at best, was waning.
And comedy was kind of in a slump at that point,
I wasn't selling the amount of tickets or playing the same venues. And I just said, you know what? I'm not going to put myself through that. It's really disheartening. I don't need to go and show up at a Howie Mandel-promoted concert and see a half-empty theater.
Yeah.
That's a little disheartening.
Yeah.
And I don't want to do that anymore. So I'm going to leave. I'm just going to back off. As luck would have it, I get a phone call from my manager saying NBC is going to do this huge game show. They're going to allot five full primetime nights to this game show, and they want you to do it. And I went, no fucking way. I've just made a decision. I'm out. And I'm kind of proud of what I've done. I've done about 10 comedy specials.
And comedians back then didn't do game shows. Absolutely. It was like Pat Sajak and Alex Trebek. Regis was like the wild one.
Right. Regis was the wild
one.
No comics did it. Yeah. Not until one generation before me did. You know, Groucho Marx had done.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, and You Bet Your Life and Johnny had done. But not in my generation. Mm-hmm. And
this is pre-Steve Harvey and all those guys.
They owe me. So the currency... of irony was not, when you're dealing with irony, you don't want to be that guy. You don't want to be the punchline.
Right.
So I said, no. I get a third call back because they weren't giving up. And they said, can they just show you the show? Can they show you the show? I go, fine. I'm not going anywhere. I'm at Jerry's Deli.
Over on Ventura?
Yeah. If he wants to come over and talk to me, let the guy come to me. I don't even want to go to a meeting for a game. I don't want to do a fucking game show. He brings over a piece of art cardboard that he cut. It looked like a 7-year-old had done an art project. Not even like, spent no money, nothing at Kinko's. They had told me that this is a big show all around the world, and NBC is going to put this on every night of primetime. I've never heard of any that kind of, they were all in on it. Mm-hmm. And then the guy shows up with, he made it with a Sharpie and his own scissors. And he plays the game. And you know the game deal. There's no game. Yeah. There's no trivia. There's no skill. And he goes, I just want to show you. Thanks for taking your time and call me when you think about it. I go home and my wife says, what did you do? I said, well, I did nothing. She goes, are you going to take it? And I said, no. And she goes, why? I said, because it'll ruin my career. She goes, where are you standing right now? I said, well, we're in the kitchen. And she says, where did you just come from? I go, well, I was by myself at the deli having soup. She goes, you realize that is your career right now. So you might as well just do it. You've always said, Howie, you've said, okay, everything sounded, it was crazy that you were going to be a comedian. It's crazy that you were going to be on a dramatic ensemble series. Just do it. So this is a Friday. So I called and I said, I'd like to do it. They go, thank you. We couldn't do it without you. And I said, so when does it tape? Monday. They go, Monday? Well, don't you have to build a set? It's built. Well, don't you have to hire 26 models? No, we have them. They're cast. So you got to think, how far down the rung was I in choices to do the show? You know, that they couldn't do without me because everybody else had said no. So I asked them in the weekend if I could hire a couple of comics, and I hired a bunch of comics, my friends. And I figured, you know, we looked at You Bet Your Life, and that's why I know that. You know, maybe I can find a way to showcase myself and my wittiness and funniness and silliness. You know, every night on NBC, when do you get that kind of exposure? Yeah. So we wrote some things and I had some ideas. And I went out, and I could show you this. I kept the picture too. The very first girl, I have her picture too. Karen Van. They said, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Deal or No Deal. This is Howie Mandel. And I walked out and there was this young lady. And I was standing like I'm standing and talking to you, sitting and talking to you, but I was standing. And I said, what's your name? And her name is Karen Van. And I said, tell me about yourself. And she told me that she's a mother of three and the boys were sitting right there behind her. And she's never owned a home. She doesn't have health insurance. She doesn't have. And then I noticed after the first offer was $10,000. And I had never been, you know, at that time, you have to, besides Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, $1 million. And it still is. Outside of LA and New York, life-changing amount. Not only that, I think $10,000 is a life-changing amount. If you talk to somebody from the middle of the country, if you can give them 10 grand right now, they could put a down payment on a house. They could buy insurance. They could change their life. And the first offer was $10,000. And she just, no thought. She went, no deal. And and I remember just looking at her and I could see the glaze when somebody who isn't in television is standing on a set in Hollywood with 20 cameras around them, 300 people, the lights. She was just having the best time in her life. But I realized that this was real money. And that's when I got scared. I said, if I start doing my comedy and I start making it about Howie, then I'm going to pull the focus from the game. And she's making already starting to make bad decisions based on her own, you know, little fairy tale world that she's come into in Hollywood. I can't pull focus. And that changed and informed my cadence of how I played that game.
Really?
And the way, oh yeah, because I talked to her. And if you watch me, even now it airs, you know, Wednesday nights on CNBC. Mm-hmm. If you watch me, I talk to people like I would talk to my children. Where I go, listen,
the offer is
$25,000. Think about this, okay? That's probably what you're making a year. You've been here 10 minutes. $25,000 is yours if you hit the button. Or do you want a chance at $1 million? So this is guaranteed. I'm going to hand you $25,000. So that it became about really driving home what it is.
Yeah.
And that's how I played the game. Yeah. And then when the game finished, I did 6 episodes. When the game finished, I was mortified because I had done none of my comedy. I had done none of what I thought was entertaining. And as luck would have it, it aired the first night and I get a call saying this went through the roof. And then it airs the second night and they said it's bigger. And by the fifth night, it had exploded. I got back. I landed in Miami. And within 30 seconds, the first person that made eye contact with me went, D. deal or no deal. And then it became, they really fast. And then if you look, on every show, they went. So the next show that came out is Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader, with which Jeff Foxworthy. Mm-hmm. And then they hired Bob Saget to do One Versus 100.
Yeah.
And then they hired Louis Anderson to do Family Feud. And then they hired, then it just, now it's, nobody thinks, gives a second thought to the fact that comics were nowhere.
Yeah.
On the game shows.
Yeah.
And, that all came right after that. And nothing has changed my life more, given me more success than Deal or No Deal.
Yeah. And you probably wouldn't have AGT.
And with no, I wouldn't have AGT, definitely. And people start buying tickets to my shows again, to my live stand-up shows again.
Well, speaking of that, I want to wrap up by bringing it back to your special on Showtime. It's called Howie Mandel Presents Howie Mandel at the Howie Mandel Comedy Club. I really enjoyed it. And you've always done, like I said, a lot of this crowd work and improvisation in your act. It looks a lot like this new special is totally spontaneous. Most comics probably work a year or two to build an hour-long set so they can do a comedy special. What is it like for you? I mean, is this totally improvised?
Is there an obviously outline? I have material. There's no way that I'm going to put myself in front of an audience for a national broadcast like this without any plan.
Mm-hmm.
But in the philosophy that we've been talking about, I'm open. And if you want to draw me down another path, you could draw me down. So when you watch the show, I'm not the one that opens the door. The audience has a tendency to open the door. So within the confines of whatever I'm doing, if somebody yells something out, if somebody does something in the room, if something is happening in that moment, it's not beyond me to bring it up, to talk about it. It's also a taped show so that if it didn't work and it went down the other way, I could cut it out. Yeah. It is as it was. And it was a fun audience who was excited to be there. And they I look at it like a giant party and I'm just trying to be the center of attention. I had a lot of fun. I hope the people there had a lot of fun. And I hope anybody who watches it has as much fun as I did.
Yeah, it looked like they did. So hecklers are welcome at Howie Mandel shows?
Yeah, I don't think of people as hecklers as much as participants.
Okay.
heckler for me, the connotation is you suck, this is shit, I want my money back. Nobody said that, but people did yell out. Yeah. I did have some critiques, mostly about aesthetics. There was somebody who didn't like the lighting.
Yeah, something with the lighting.
Yeah, some lady didn't like the lighting, and nobody asked her.
I find it fascinating. I feel like that's probably an Atlantic City crowd right there.
Probably is. I just find it fascinating that somebody would go to a taping. It's not a secret. This is my special. And then feel the need to criticize, maybe in hopes that I would change or relight. Or I have no idea what her issues were.
Now, you also joke about your OCD and your ADHD on the show. Ever since you came out about your mental health issues or whatever you want to call it, it's kind of become a part of your persona. I wonder, do you ever worry that people's first mental association with you is going to be, he's the guy who won't shake hands or something like that before your career and all the stuff that you've accomplished? Or
do you feel that
if you're a vessel for that kind of thing, then so be it. Then that's a good thing
at
the end of
the
day.
You answered the question.
Really?
I don't care. I do what I do and I am who I am. Not for anybody but me.
Mm-hmm.
It just so happens that what I do happens to demand some attention outside. Yeah. I'm a comedian, but I don't need to be famous. I just need to do stand-up comedy.
Mm-hmm.
I happened, because I'm a child of the 50s, to accidentally on a radio show talk about my mental health issues, and there was a stigma attached to the fact for somebody from my generation to say that I had mental health issues. Mm-hmm. I suffer from depression and anxiety and OCD and ADHD. I've got almost the whole alphabet. And I go see, I've always been coddled by a family that has loved me and supported me. And I see professionals. And as we talk, I'm medicated. I didn't know I could talk about it. And when I accidentally did, and it was accidentally, it kind of opened up this door of, feeling, oh my God, I'm not alone.
Mm-hmm.
And it is an issue that we all, and not only is it an issue, I think it's the answer to, making this world better. If everybody would take care of their mental health, like we take care of our dental health, you go get checked up, you go see if you have no cavities. Nobody just goes gets checked up, and mm-hmm. we need coping skills. And whether the coping skill yeah. is because you broke up with somebody, a marriage, because you lost somebody, because they're somebody yeah. passed away, yeah. whether you can't handle all the pressure at work,
yeah.
whether you don't have
nobody
to have,
teaches that to kids along the way or adults
or
along
humans.
The way.
And yeah. then, you know, we, yeah. and we look for other reasons. Well, it's gun control. No, mm-hmm. well, it's mental control.
yeah.
You know, a lot of people can have a gun and not, and I'm not pro gun or anti gun. I'm just pro human health.
Right.
You know, and we're not healthy. And we yeah. don't want to tell people, you know, it's really interesting. You can go tell somebody, you know what, I don't know if I could lift that. My back is bad. But nobody will say, I don't think I can do that because I'm just not functioning mentally mm-hmm. well today. I don't think I can handle yeah. this kind of pressure. You won't say
so
that
true.
Out loud, or you'll excuse yourself to go to the dentist, but you say, listen, I got a psychiatry appointment and I'm low on my meds. I don't think in middle America that's as acceptable as maybe mm-hmm. it is in this office where we talk.
Yeah, good for you for addressing that. I just want to wrap up by asking you one question that's been kind of in the back of my mind for a long time. Is there a secret to winning America's Got Talent? Do certain acts do better than others?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think that ultimately, you know, talent is subjective. And if you're cognizant of, I think you have to show up and be you and not give mm-hmm. it any thought, because winning that contest doesn't necessarily mean you're the best. It mm-hmm. also doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have the most fruitful career. You know, Susan Boyle came in second. She's doing fantastic. Courtney Hadwin didn't win my Golden Buzzer this year, and she's got a record deal, and she's going to yeah. be a huge yeah. star like Grace that'll go on from time to time. But if you want to win the contest, know your audience. And mm-hmm. the people that vote, you know, it's really funny because I can't tell you, there a day doesn't go by when somebody goes, I think you got it wrong, man. You know who should have won that one? You know who's much better? And I'll always say to that person, and it's usually an adult, I'll go, did you vote? And they'll go, no, I just think the wrong yeah. one won. Well, if you know who's, you know, it's usually a lot of them are 12-year-old females. I think if you're doing something that would cater to that audience, not that you shouldn't, but even the music choice you have, the way you're talking, sometimes you're going to win it just by what you say before and what you say after rather than yeah. what happens, because they'll just like you and you become
That's
popular.
True.
But know who you're speaking to
yeah.
and know who's in the room
yeah.
is a good piece of advice.
Well, again, Howie's new special is called Howie Mandel Presents Howie Mandel at the Howie Mandel Comedy Club. It premieres Friday, January 18th at 10 Eastern and Pacific on Showtime. You can catch Deal or No Deal on Wednesdays at 9 a.m. on CNBC, and AGT Champions airs Mondays on NBC at 8, 7 Central. Howie Mandel, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Howie Mandel for coming on the podcast. Just a reminder to watch Howie Mandel Presents Howie Mandel at the Howie Mandel Comedy Club this Friday, January 18th at 10 Eastern and Pacific on Showtime. Deal or No Deal airs Wednesdays at 9 a.m. on CNBC, and AGT Champions airs Mondays on NBC at 8, 7 Central. And follow Howie on Twitter at Howie Mandel. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.